the naturalists make a major departure from the other two in that they cut off this part over here and these meanings of sexuality and concentrate totally on bringing sex into the scientific realm, the observable, the material, the scientific theoretical realm. The important point here in making this distinction between these two realms is that in this realm over here, the realm of science, value judgments are taboo. And so bringing sex entirely into that realm means that we take it out of this area of trying to figure out whether it's good or evil, dirty, clean, or whatever, perverted, those types of things, and talk about it in an objective way that sort of sanitizes sex. It doesn't have to be considered dirty or studied that way as being dirty or clean or revealing it to us higher meanings of life or not, or what kinds of meanings. So there's a tradition that in naturalists' points of view and writings about sex too that go back into earlier forms of pornography, probably in the West, England and the United States, especially England, because our background is English, so that's mostly what we're acquainted with. Writing such as Fanny Hill, Tom Jones, early pornography was pretty much this kind of natural, happy kind of approach, that it was just a part of everyday life. The kinds of sex that are written about in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. You know, it's just a part of life, and a fun part of life sometimes, kind of like eating, you know, breathing, other types of things that are natural. They can be a chore sometimes, other times we can build them in such a way that they create enjoyment for us. In nonfiction, well, Walt Whitman was another, before I get to nonfiction, Walt Whitman would be another figure that dealt with sex at this level. D.H. Lawrence also wrote about sex in a naturalistic way. And Henry Miller, too, although Henry Miller has been so castigated by authorities in the past that many people would thought of him as a Gnostic. But I don't think he did write that way. I think it was more opening channels to just simply sex as a form of enjoyment. Modern figures that would stand out would be Hugh Hefner and the Playboy philosophy. Health or naturist movements, nudist camps, these types of things. Sigmund Freud would be a nonfiction writer that considered sex pretty much in a naturalistic way, although there's some Jehovah's tendencies there too. Yes,
thinking,
Alana?
I was thinking Hugh Hefner seemed to me to be more of the fantasy, the Gnostic kind of type. And I mean, I haven't looked at the Playboy in a long time, but I mean, to me, that was all set up for fantasy.
Yeah, well, fantasy, right. Now, Hugh Hefner's another kind of guy that has been, over the past, Jehovah's really considered to be an enemy, and probably would depict him as a Gnostic. But I think if you read the Playboy philosophy, he's not trying to hurt other people, you know, or dominate,
okay,
or that type of thing. It's supposed to be a mutual enjoyment and fantasy that are fantasies that aren't too kinky, you know, that as long as there's consenting adults, you know, it's all right. The way that sex has been studied in psychology in recent years is also from this naturalist perspective. The writings of Masters and Johnson, for example, and before that Alfred Kinsey. There's the naturalists probably fall into two camps, those that see sex as just not harmful, versus the other side that sees sex as essential for mental health. In other words, look at it as in a positive way. But what characterizes a lot of their writings is to take the wonder or the mystery out of sex and to bring it down to this behavioristic, logical, rational plane. The three characteristics of their writings would be a materialization of sex. In other words, pretty much just studying sex behavior or observing sex behavior. A biological bias in looking at normal and abnormal sex is pretty much just what animals and humans generally do. It's sort of almost a statistical meaning of abnormal or normal sex. The biological bias also means that the mental component of sex is not considered very important, not studied very much. And then the trend in psychology and the social sciences in this century, the trend called behaviorism, is also very apparent in these writings. In a way, you get the feeling that these people who write about sex from this perspective have never done it themselves. You know, they've pretty much just observed other people or questioned them with attitude surveys and so on. President, who was it? I guess it was President Johnson commissioned a national group, a commission to study pornography and obscenity in 1970. And this was a commission from the executive branch of government. And so a bunch of experts came together and they commissioned a lot of studies done by psychologists and sociologists and so on the effect of pornography and obscenity on behavior. This report was, the commission was still going on when Johnson left office and Richard Nixon became president. So the final report was delivered when Nixon was president and he refused to accept it. And mainly because the commission had said that we should get rid of obscenity laws. That's a form of censorship that isn't needed, that inhibits people's freedoms, and pornography and obscenity aren't that bad anyway. The Jehovanists, and there was one of them on the commission itself, also rejected, and I suppose Nixon was following along their line, rejected the report. And it's easy to see why, because all of the studies were done from this naturalist perspective. They left out this other higher meaning of sexuality. So, not even talking about those things. It may be that the naturalists study the behavior pretty much also for political reasons, to stay out of problems, to raise the status of sex in a way, as something that can be studied scientifically. So they use the aura of science as a way to make the discussion of sex less political, less politically charged. A lot of their writings are an attempt to expose sexual myths, like the harmfulness of masturbation, the fact that people do in private a lot of perverted things, and they speak in public as if they don't. We've studied, I mentioned myth here too, and this has come up a couple times I think in this class already, and looking at myth, there's a myth for a long time, for several decades in this century, was downgraded and considered to be defined as illusion, as untruth. And with the writings of people like Claude Levi-Strauss and other anthropologists and C.J. Jung and so on, now myth is being resurrected again and talked about as a way to approach truth, or having underlying truth. So to expose sexual myths gets into this kind of a paradox. Well, are we talking about myth as an illusion? And I think that's what they want to say. But then somebody else comes in and says, yeah, but these myths, maybe they have some kind of underlying truth to them. So the naturalists go out and study sex behavior of other peoples, like anthropologists do, find out what other people do. The Commission on Pornography checked all through what are called the human relations area files, where anthropologists, when they go out and study some group, they write up their ethnographies, what they found, and then there's this thing that comes out of Harvard University called the human relations area files, and that's where all of these ethnographies of everybody that's ever been studied by anthropologists is found. And so the commission commissioned studies for people to go through that and find the sex practices of as many people as possible, to find if there's any common characteristics or whatever. And so, you know, you can find that something has been prohibited someplace always, and you can always find those same things have been not prohibited some places. So that, in other words, there's a lot of variability.
Were there mostly men on that commission?
I'd say 99 to 100%.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of that, and I was thinking, when you put that line there and divided, took out the mystical and spiritual, or else the higher meaning of sex, it seemed to me that you have, you know, I'm really generalizing, what men are socialized to be on the one side, without the metaphysical and spiritual, and then with the metaphysical and spiritual, or what women are socialized to understand sexuality as. So I thought, yeah, if there were mostly men studying that, and men are like more the conditioned to be more of the naturalist perspective, then that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I suppose just, I think this would be supported too by scientific findings too, that men have an easier time divorcing sexuality from personality. Mm-hmm. And so the naturalist perspective would be more of a male approach. Hopefully, I don't know if we'll have time today, but at least by tomorrow we'll get into some of these sexual myths dealing with male sexual aggression and female sexuality too. Because I think it's, you know, what's being discovered now is that just studying this side of it gets us into paradoxes and problems, and that we have to move to another level to solve those problems or contradictions. And so there's a return to looking at these ancient myths to, as an indication of a higher or broader meaning of these things. So remember a few sessions ago I asked you, I was talking about the understanding of self, the Jehovenist view of self as this unitary phenomenon that one protects and puts a shell around and that shouldn't be penetrated or sullied, dirtied, because it's fragile and can change quickly and then be a vehicle for changing relationships with others and eventually society. The Gnostics, of course, had that similar view of self, but they said that should be done. We should change that. We have to drop away or get rid of this encumbered meanings of our identity that society gives us. And we have to find our true self that's way down in there someplace. The naturalists have a different understanding of self. And their idea, as the modern sense, is the self is very fluid. It's very unstable. It changes from situation to situation and time to time. The idea of the self is more like it's Teflon coated, that a lot of things don't affect it. It's an idea that probably doesn't have a lot of existence in reality. It's the idea that probably that our sex partners won't affect us for very long afterwards. We can forget about it quickly. We can move to a new setting. Nudity, you know, does not affect the self. This is, the Gnostics would find nudity, of course, very erotic and seek it out. Gnostics would go to, let's say, clothing optional beaches as a way of getting sexually excited and to seek out sexuality. Whereas nudists or naturalists would say, well, this is just, you know, the way things are, that we don't have to, we can divorce sex from these other things like nudity. The naturalists would believe that contamination of the self will not spread to others. So in other words, gays should be allowed to teach school and to be around young children because it's not going to rub off on those young children. The contamination is not harmful. It won't change those people. Because sex is not harmful, there's no real need to contain it within something like the marriage institution. In fact, an outcome of naturalism would be an open marriage idea as a way of achieving marital and sexual health. Perversions are a difficult word for the naturalists. They don't want to use that word. They'd rather talk about less emotionally charged terms like aberrations or variations. rather than perversions. So one of the consequences, of course, of the naturalist position is that it's the increasing sexual tolerance in the society has, for a lot of people, made sex not so much a big deal. So you get the reverse problem of the problem of that the Gnostics and the Jehovahists saw, in that you have a lot of people that maybe aren't so interested in sex anymore. That it seems to be like an everyday phenomenon that they can just sort of do with or without. So now there's the naturalists have the problem of promoting sexual desire. So you start seeing clinics springing up, you know, for people who don't have enough sexual desire.
Why do they need to promote it?
As a form of mental health.
Yeah. Sexual dysfunctionality.
Yeah. Right. You know, there's different schools of this thought, and so they have different reasons for doing this. But the way that one overcomes their sexual dysfunctions is learning new behaviors, new sequences of behaviors. It's not solving a dilemma that has to do with the spirit, or solving a dilemma that has to do with one's basic understanding of oneself as a human or a woman or a man. So sex clinics use behavioristic or behavior modification models as a form of therapy. So a telling difference between these three ideologies that I've talked about so far is the way they deal with violence and the way they consider violence in relationship to sex. It's very accustomed to talk about sex and violence, you know, which should be censored. But what about the Jehovahists? Which do you think they have more trouble with, sex or violence?
Sex.
Yeah, why would you think that is?
It's more of an individual intrusion.
Well, isn't violence too? Like if I come over and hit you in the face or something?
Yeah, but I mean, you choose it.
Okay, well, you don't choose sex.
No, you choose sex, but you don't choose the violence. You choose to participate in the intrusion, where you don't necessarily choose to participate in the intrusion.
Well, but the Jehovahists may, you know, if you listen to Jerry Falwell and, you know, a lot of these, but they actually would promote violent confrontations or the use of violence.
Kill a commie for Christ.
Yeah, kill a commie for Christ. You know, that's, you know, in terms of censorship. It gets ludicrous in some cases because, you know, if somebody gets all excited about a movie that portrays sex, and then there's horrible kinds of violence in that movie, and you think why wasn't anybody concerned about that? Or then the other side too, where do you think the naturalists would come down on violence and sex?
Why is that? Tell me.
Well, that's what I would say that the naturalists would come down more against violence.
Oh, yeah.
And the desire to censor violence.
Yeah. That's less of a natural act. I think the naturalists are more into natural things, and sex is just part of being a humanoid unit, while violence really isn't natural. It's some aggressive act to gain territorial rights or being able to...
Well, I think you're really on shaky. And before you go on, I think you're really on shaky ground saying that violence is less natural than sex.
Well, violence comes out of like gaining or obtaining or the an ability to express oneself by just being able to hit somebody is a lot easier to do than trying to explain oneself or talk it out.
Yeah, but I would think if you watch children play, that violence is a lot more endemic to their play than sex. Although probably that enters too.
They can express themselves, obtain territorial rights.
Well, okay, but I remember, you know, like when I was a graduate student and going to a forum on, at that time it was on the Vietnam War. And there was a psychiatrist from UCLA who talked. And he brought up this issue. You know, he said, you had the one side that believes, you know, watching sex is going to make people go out and do it. and you know, ruin their lives. And so that has to be controlled and censored. And on the other side, you have people thinking that watching violence is going to make people do it. You know, like censoring children's cartoons because you don't want them to be violent. And so, but why is there the difference? What is the common dimension, or is there one, that by which you could understand why the naturalists would be more against portrayals of violence and the Jehovah's against portrayals of sex?
May I take a shot at dark, but the naturalists seem to deny the darker side of mankind, which would, I would associate with the violent acts, you know, and the Jehovah's, they don't deny the darker side of man. And they, that'd be, I don't know, maybe.
But wouldn't they be against violence, like
against
sex?
Against violence, but they would be more willing to accept that it's, that's the way man is. You know, it's more than, more like his nature.
I think, you know, it's an interesting question. Does anybody else want to say something? Where I was coming from, or where I would come from, is from the perspective of understanding the nature of the self and how the how that varies between these two, the way I've just been, I was talking about that, where the Jehovahists would be more like uptight people. You know, they're like Garrison Keillor. He talks about, I don't know, I heard one time on the Prairie Home Companion, he was talking about the problems in the local Lutheran church about the sharing of the peace. You know, and he says, he says, one thing, you never approach a Norwegian head on. It's always from the side. Protestant people have a hugging, you know, and touching other people. If you think about violence, that makes a person even more uptight. A person withdraws even more into themselves. Like if you have a violent confrontation with somebody, you get really stiff, you know, and nothing's going to penetrate you, and all your defenses come up, and it's a preservation of self against some threat. To me, that would explain why the Jehovahists don't have so much problem with violence, because they're saying I'm upholding my society, myself. And I'm keeping anything from entering it or coming in contact with it.
If they're more uptight about violence, why don't they care as much about it? Is that what you were just saying?
That's what I was saying. That violence actually plays into their hands because it makes people more uptight. You know, it's a psychological mechanism for preventing or for identifying enemies and preventing contamination with enemies. It's obvious in our daily life. Now, you know, like we're taught to hate the Russians, you know. Mm-hmm. That means that we don't want to have any contact with them, you know. Let them come into our sphere of influence at all. We can't even talk to them.
For Mormons people.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. The naturalists, however, see violence as a real, you know, in emphasizing the self, it's a real threat to the destruction of the self. In terms of humanity, you know, in terms of existence, that you can be hurt. And they see, you know, that sex should be a relaxed and fluid type of thing. So it's not so much a threat to them. They like, you know, sex should be more of a relaxing thing, you know, and laid back. Whereas violence goes against this idea of this Teflon self, so to speak, or this penetratable self that enjoys new experiences and enjoys constant change and development. And this, I think, also is depicted in the way that these two groups look at rape. Now, the naturalists have a problem because rape is this thing that combines sex and violence. And so the common way that naturalists get out from under that one to redefine rape as not having anything to do with sex. And this is very common among people who do rape counseling and who come from a more naturalist perspective. Rape is not sex. Rape is about power and domination. Well, what the hell is sex about, too? I mean, this is the part of it that they don't say, that there's a lot of sex that has to do with power and domination, too. And in fact, maybe most sex, especially from a male perspective, has to do with power and domination. And it's a very difficult issue for men to handle and for our society to handle. That's sort of a bridge into talking about male sexual aggression, too. So, you know, then on the other hand, the Gnostics embrace both sex and violence. this is both ways going beyond beyond social dictates and social controls.
George, to support that, what you were saying too, the class I taught on human sexuality at the university, the class was asked to identify meanings given to sexual intercourse, and they would give as many as 40 or 50 meanings, and always, you have to check the list, about 50% of them were negative, and often, and had to do almost always with control or vengeance or whatever else it may be. So it just would come out very blatantly.
Oh, okay.
Class.
Was it by sex lines?
The differences were male black. Male black, black males.
There's also a difference in the way that these ideologies relate to politics. The Jehovahists are not afraid of too much authority. Well, as I said the other day, all of these ideologies are ideal types. Nobody holds probably one of them in its true, you know, unadulterated form. Almost all of us, maybe the way I've related them to you, you can see that probably you believe some of all of them, or maybe maybe you leave one out. And it's true, too, in practice, the purpose of ideal types is for comparison purposes. To see how much in one direction, or how much of one thing, or how ideal this particular approach is in time and history, or within any individual person. But in reality, of course, there's people are in between, and most theoreticians are too. I said Freud is considered a naturalist, but there's a lot of Jehovahism in Freud too, in dealing with some of the bad aspects of unrestrained sexuality, and Freud said that restraining sexual energy can have positive benefits for civilization, and that people can channel that sexual energy into creative activities. In the 30s, there was a tendency in social sciences to write grand theories of all societies. Historians were doing this, people like Arnold Toynbee and Gibbon and so on, you know, trying to take all of human history and put it in some theoretical form. And they were very influenced by Freudian thought, and a lot of them came down with the idea that the difference between civilizations that sort of stop and don't progress like ours did into technology and so on have to do with which societies restrict sex and the most and which don't. But that's been pretty thoroughly undermined now, that idea. But you can see how the importance of sex to those social theorists. Most of these ideologues will buttress their arguments too, not by just stating them in their pure form, but by making connections to other things that people don't like. For example, the Jehovahists will say something like VD, venereal disease, proves that unrestricted sex is bad. So, you know, for health reasons, we need to also restrict sex. Some of them would go so far as to say preventing VD, like through the use of condoms or finding cures, is not a good thing, because VD is a punishment for sin, and so we should allow people to go ahead and suffer that. Some people go so far as to defend anti-abortion legislation because it is a proper penalty for unrestricted getting pregnant. In other words, is a penalty that women suffer. A punishment for sin. some of you may not believe. I can't believe that. You know, when I say that, I can't believe that people actually believe that. But I have argued that point with one of the members of my church, where she was saying that welfare mothers, poverty mothers, should not get benefits for out of wedlock pregnancies and so on, because it's proper punishment for what they've done. Mm-hmm.
And the children are the ones being punished. That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense when you just say it, but people really do believe it. that unrestricted sexuality can show its results in things like mental illness, tension, things like that. Neuroses of one sort or another. Pornography leads to unhealthy sex attitudes and behavior. Prostitution leads to lesbianism, frigidity. People who go to prostitutes are latent homosexuals.
And, Mr. Holiness, you're still...
Right. These are kind of buttressing their arguments with other things. Homosexuality is really a mental illness. It leads to other psychic disturbances. There's Jehovah's psychiatrists, of course, and sociologists who will defend these particular points of view. Sociologists might point out that areas of cities where like prostitution take place are areas also where there's other kinds of crime, that unrestricted prostitution and pornography and so on leads to the involvement of organized crime in those activities. So you see those connections that are made there. Neither side, you know, in these arguments can really have win the day. You know, they never really are in total control, and their arguments are never really fully accepted by everybody at all time. So they have interim positions, you know, like or fallback positions that they can swing with, so to speak. Jehovah's have advocated castration of people who are sexually deviant in the past.
And the defertilization of pills for Africans or other cultures that are having too many.
Yeah, or symbolic castration by through the taking of hormones that restrict testosterone. I clipped an article out of Ms. Magazine one time written by Alan Alda. It was really a cute article. It was a takeoff on those Reader's Digest articles that identify new illnesses and say, you know, are you a sufferer from this or that? And then what to do if you live with a sufferer, you know, 10 steps to health in this area. And the disease that he was writing about was called testosterone poisoning, which is a male disease. He was going on about it, one of the weird things it causes males to do. You know, they're just so highly abnormal, like causing wars and things like that. Castration, of course, is a pretty drastic measure. So Jehovah's have also advocated things like distraction. You know, get kids playing sports, you know, and involved in activities, and they won't think about sex. Containment or ecological control by confining vice areas in cities to particular districts so that it won't contaminate the rest of the society. The naturalists advocate even practically opposite solutions. They're in favor, for example, of dilution of what we would call sexual abnormality, spreading it out so that it's not so effective in just one area. And in fact, this has become a strategy for cities in dealing with these vice areas. Because if you have, you know, vice areas are okay if you're white, middle class, live in the suburbs, because then you know where to go to have fun. But if you actually live in those areas, they're not very nice. And in fact, people, the reputation rubs off on them. You know, it's thought that by people who live in the suburbs, the people who live in those areas are by the fact they live in those areas deviant. And the persons who go to those areas are somehow non-deviant. And that definition, you know, saves their own sense of self and their own sense of their own morality. But cities, Detroit was one of the cities that pioneered this effort of passing zoning laws that say that you cannot have sex businesses within so many blocks of one another, so that no one neighborhood will become known like that, but it will be spread out through a wider area. And so the common everyday life of a community or a neighborhood won't be so affected. There's always the fear of the Jehovah's that the Gnostics are lying under the naturalist arguments some ways, you know, somewhere, and using the naturalist arguments to push their own thing, which is true, I think, in some cases. The the early Supreme Court's cases that, that allowed recognized works of literature to be available to people in the United States, like James Joyce's book Ulysses, or Fanny Hill, or something like that. We're on the basis that, taken as a whole, these things are good literature, and so they shouldn't be restricted just because of an out-of-context piece of sex or something that's in those books. Well, the Gnostics, of course, use that to, you know, sort of say, well, any pornography is okay then, you know, and can use be shielded by those Supreme Court decisions to make a lot of other kinds of things available that aren't so much on their surface good works of literature. The Jehovahists, of course, through the Reagan and Nixon court, Supreme Court, have changed the definition of pornography or obscenity. The difference is that pornography, the difference between those two terms, if you don't know, is that pornography is a literary term and obscenity is a legal term. The term pornography is not used in legal language or in court cases. But they essentially, for our purposes, mean the same thing. But the Nixon and the Reagan court have redefined the definition of obscenity from the phrase lacking serious content to having, they've changed it to utterly without. Or no, excuse me, it's the other way around. The older definition was utterly without socially redeeming value. Well, it was pretty easy to show that almost any pornography have some thread in there someplace of you know, like a humorous, makes people laugh. Well, the Nixon court and the Reagan court have changed that to lacking serious intent. So it covers a much wider area of literature. Naturalists also hide behind various kinds of filters. The literary filter is one of them. The medical filter is another one. So that you can show that a lot of sex has medical purposes. This is where, doctors or like Masters and Johnson would be a perfect example. They can write all about sex only from a medical perspective, then it's okay. You know, but you could write the same things they did from a purely, not totally, of course, because you wouldn't do the parts where they hook up, you know, all these little devices. Yeah. But you can write a lot of the same things just from a voyeuristic point of view. But again, the medical filter can be used by Gnostics as a shield for their activity. The use of sex surrogates, for example, in sexual dysfunction clinics. A lot of Jehovahists would say, that sounds an awful lot like prostitution. You go pay somebody to have sex with them. Only the sex surrogate, do you understand, are you acquainted with the use of sex surrogates? Some of these sexual dysfunction clinics, if a man goes there who's impotent and can't have sex, then there'll be a therapist that can teach him through behavior modification methods to overcome his impotence. Well, that's a lot of people go to prostitutes for that same reason.
I was just curious about your definition of sex surrogate. You just said if you can't have sex. Now, are you thinking that sex and orgasm are the same thing? Is there a difference? Or
well, yeah. I'm thinking, okay. You know, in terms of erection and you know, having sort of the meaning of impotence. Okay. The general meaning of impotence. Now, you know, again, that's I bet you're talking about a male point of view on these things,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how many times women have...
Well, I don't think women go to sex surrogates so much.
But I mean, I wondered the definition, that, you know, if you're talking about orgasm as the sex, I mean, then you're having sex, because then a lot of women don't have sex a lot, you know, even though they're participating in a sexual act. So I was just curious about what the definition is.
Well, I'm talking about like a copulation, in this sense. Although, you know, there's a lot of men who have difficulty achieving an erection and copulation, who would consider themselves very sexual and sexually active. Paraplegics, you know, have been talking this way.
Right. I was just curious about what you were defining it as. Not, I wasn't trying to argue with you, but just trying to find out what you were saying.
Well, yeah, in this sense, when we're talking about sexual dysfunction clinics, it's mostly copulation. The attitudes, well, let's see. I won't go with that. Attitudes toward sex tend to be a lot like attitudes toward capital punishment. They're indication of a wider world view, and they're difficult to attack or to change on the basis of some facts. People make up their mind about capital punishment very rarely on the basis of facts about deterrence, you know, the effect of capital punishment or something like that. Their understanding of capital punishment has to do with a whole other set of beliefs, ideologies, ideologically based. And I think sex is like this too. And so these ideologies may vary from time to time, but depending on social circumstances that are going on, the outside threat to people. I mentioned this the other day in terms of the Hebrews, that the resurrection of the law in Hebrew history has a lot to do with the threats that the society was undergoing or had undergone in a particular time. After the Jews were, of course, the law came about after the Jews were expelled from Egypt, after the wandering and the settling down. Jehovanism seems to occur after particular social crises or rapid social change, when people want to get the thing back together again and assert more control, after there's been a period of some kind of crisis of one sort or another. The law, historians of the law say that it fell out of in other words, wasn't followed so closely for a while until after the Babylonian captivity, and the people returned to Israel. Then the law was resurrected again, and in a much more restrictive way. The Jehovanism occurred also at the end of the breakup of the ancient classical world, around 1000 to 1300 AD, and at the time when Aquinas was writing. There was a period of rapid social change going on at that time, or just accomplished at that time. The influence of the plagues, for example, movement around, vast migrations of people in Europe. After the Renaissance and the Counter-Reformation, there was again another restriction of sex. After the advent of industrialization and all the crises in society that caused, that we identify with the Victorian era in Anglo-American social history. And then after the Vietnam War and Watergate, again, and we see a return to more restrictive and authoritarian structures in the society. One way of looking at it would be like this: if we consider society to be going along for a while, and then there's periods of rapid change or social crisis, and then there's a return to normality for a while, like this, Jehovanism seems to occur at these points, or more directly right there, after the crisis. Gnosticism appears at times to promote the crisis or to promote the change. And then naturalism occurs more at these times when nobody cares very much about, you know, anything. Things are going along kind of smoothly.
How would you define these times, George, then? I mean, I think of us being natural, more in the natural film stage, but I think of us being in kind of crisis times.
Yeah, well, I think we've emerged recently from a period of social crisis, and that we find, you know, with the return of the Republicans to office, and the call for more social restraint in life. There's more controls on children now than there was a few years ago. Bringing about authoritarian structures of one sort or another. Stability of the family, you know, more of a concern about that.
So what are you saying, George? Where do you see us then?
Yeah.
Well, I see us at this time of a rise of Jehovanism again right now.
that we're coming down off of this thing.
But that's not a rise, then. Or that's just a difference entirely.
No, this has to do with periods of social change or crisis.
So naturalists make problems and the job is solving this other year?
Well, I think it has to do with the reflection of the times. Again, after the Civil War in the United States, there was a period of return to more control and restriction in the area of sex. Well, just a way of summarizing these ideologies, all societies have had to deal with the problem of controlling sexuality or lust, is one way of putting it, and if we talk about it as a sin. And societies have more or less not been very very successful in this area. It's one of the areas that seems to really be a problem for social control. There's, I think, another point to bring up that sort of connects it with what I was talking about at the very beginning is that all of these ideologies attempt to talk about the split between everyday and erotic reality, and to consider it and to heal that split in a certain way. For the Jehovahists, they want to deny erotic reality, that it doesn't exist or shouldn't exist. It does exist, but it shouldn't be allowed to exert itself in public life. The Gnostics, on the other hand, want to import erotic reality into almost all areas of everyday existence. And then the naturalists say that the distinction is not very important, that we shouldn't consider it to be a major form of thought, that we should consider it like any other form of reality, is not threatening, something that's pleasurable to use from time to time. But obviously sex then is extraordinary. It's something that people deal with in their own lives and that societies have to deal with. It may be people find it as a way of discovering about themselves and discovering about the cosmos. It raises questions and mysteries to people. People have insights that they get into their own lives that they bring from their sexual lives and their sexual experiences. Yeah?
George, out of these three choices that we have, I certainly see the naturalist as more of a healthy approach to sex.
Right. Well, you could say it's a healthy approach to sex because that's essentially what the ideology is. It's to say, sex is just like a healthy activity. But naturalism, where do you think naturalism falls down? What does that ideology have trouble dealing with?
Taking it too light.
Yeah, well, how does it deal with things like incest? There are naturalists that are pro-incest.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movement in the United States, a pro-incest movement.
There is.
How do they feel about child porn? Or rape or other forms of not so nice sexuality. How do they handle that? There does appear to be this other side of sexuality that we do experience too, that naturalism has trouble dealing with.
I mean, that side has to be comparatively nice and agreeable and consenting and everything else.
The most
of
experience,
that's not so.
Very
nice, real
quick,
and
it
doesn't seem
for a while. Wanted to. Didn't really have a lot of time today, but maybe just on the surface, probably a guy that's right in between Jehovahism and naturalism, who is considered to be one of the foremost psychiatrists that deal with sexual abnormality or aberrations, as he calls it, or variants, is a guy named Robert Stoller, who's at the UCLA Medical School. And he's mentioned in those articles that I wanted to have you read, too, that are on the reserve shelf in there, King Kong had XY chromosomes and male, female, she, he created them. Because he did this, a lot of this original research had to do with the effect of male and female hormones on the gender development of children. And so he ended up with, there's a lot of medical experimentation that went on after World War II, and the treatment of women who were pregnant with various kinds of hormones, and they tended to have children that, were hermaphroditic or had a superabundance of one kind of hormone over another that was different than their sex. And so Stoller was one of these persons that was in on that from the very beginning and setting the effects of that on these children. And so he ended up with a lot of like transsexuals, you know, people who had the body characteristics of one sex but the brain of another, transvestites. Children whose parents couldn't figure out whether they're male or female, so they sort of decided to treat them one way, but then later on the child wanted to be the other. So out of all of that, he eventually became an expert in this area. And this book, Perversion, is a very interesting book because he, I think, is probably about the most up-to-date psychiatric point of view on this. But I wanted to just show you as an example of the kinds of things that, the way he considers sexual fantasy and pornography.
So that book's called Perversion, even though he speaks of it as aberration.
Well, no, he does define perversion, but in fact, I can.
No, that's fine. It was just interesting because you mentioned
that. Yeah, in fact, what he does is this. Why don't you?
No, we have two people that have to leave at this point.
Okay. Why don't you just pass these around, kind of?
Quickly.
The generic term that he uses is aberrations. And then within aberrations, he divides that into two types, perversions and variants. And the distinction is that in perversions, there's some kind of higher psychic meaning to what the person's doing. In other words, they're doing it because of psycho-emotional reasons that they're aware of. Or they may not be so aware of them, but they're apparent to the psychoanalyst. The variant, however, is the person who undertakes an aberration of which there's no other meaning. They're just, maybe they learned wrong, you know, or something like that. That the behavior doesn't have any other higher. Yeah. And he's one of these persons that sees sexuality and sexual fantasy and pornography as necessary for mental health. And the element... What?
And he's the most up-to-date.
Yeah. Right. Now, why is sexual perversion necessary for mental health? And he pins that down to the way that we raise children. And the problem that he says that it's almost impossible for any child to come out of a nuclear family without some kind of sexual hang-ups.
And that would be you coming out of a non-nuclear family?
So this is not the whole story. Now, this is his part of the story. This is this part of the story over here. It's not this part of here. So the way that we solve these problems that we have with our mothers and fathers is through sexual perversion. And so a part of the definition of sexual excitement is, or the components of sexual excitement, one of the major components is hostility. That within sexually exciting behavior, there's an element of hostility that's there. Even though, you know, it's obvious in some cases, like rape, obviously, you know, or exhibitionism, or voyeurism, setting out actually to hurt another person, physically or mentally, is not so clear in other kinds of sexuality. But in his book, he uncovers how it may be there. For example, child pornography. Now, the person who buys a piece of child pornography, what are they identifying with in that? Are they identifying with the child? They could very well be. A child that's humiliated sexually, maybe that was that person when they were a child. The thing about sexual fantasy in that sheet that I'm passing around is that what he says is that sexual fantasy solves those old pains. In other words, everybody's sexual fantasy is going to be a little different than everybody else's. Because it's built on one's biography, where one comes from. The hostility comes from the fact that one's gender was attacked in one way or another when one was young. the most common form of perversion in pornography for males, of course, is just naked women or observing people in the sex act, you know, a heterosexual sex act. There's obviously a point of voyeurism there, seeing somebody. You think of the Penthouse magazine that had Vanessa Williams in it, the Miss America that had to, how it sold out, the high, you know, just really quickly. And I was doing some research in a prison this summer, and this guy was telling me that the most expensive magazine in the prison is that issue of Penthouse. It requires something like, it was going for like $30 to $50. And, or so many cartons of cigarettes. And, we don't really have enough time to get in this. I don't want to carry you through, because I can see with your questioning that you have, you know, some blocks that you don't understand this, and it takes some time to carry you through with this thinking. But Stoller is not talking about these higher, maybe you might consider higher forms of sexuality. He's talking about everyday sexuality. So he's saying that if it's not sexually exciting, then there probably is no hostility there. And so what he would define as perversion includes what normal heterosexual relationship in a marriage, for example.